This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in the last of the Occupy Wall Street trials, a young activist faces 7 years in prison for allegedly committing a felony assault on a police officer.
The forces in this country just won't let go of those activists who were involved in bringing us Occupy Wall Street.
We take another look at the United States practice of sentencing persons to life without possibility of parole for crimes they committed as teenagers. Despite Supreme Court decisions calling for reform in this area, progress has been slow. Jody Kent Levy of the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth joins us to talk about their work. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, I know you were here to record the show last week, and you're here this week. But in between, you've been traveling, and been traveling around your incredible new book that we've talked to you about before, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Again, Spying on Democracy, which I recommend to every listener on this show, as well as listening to Heidi talk about that. But you've been doing a lot of traveling to talk about that book. Where'd you just come back from, Heidi, and what did you talk about?
Well, I just came back from beautiful Santa Barbara, where I spoke at the William Capp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life at the University of Santa Barbara. And I talked about the way corporations are working with the government and conducting surveillance. But the week before, I was up in Vermont speaking at a town hall sponsored by Bernie Sanders with David Cole, our former guest on Law and Disorder.
And how
colleague.
Did that go?
That went really well. Great audience. Of course, they were from Vermont, so they were very supportive.
Single payer state.
And then next week, I'll be speaking at Hofstra University. So it's been a fun experience.
It's great. And I understand the book is in its third printing.
That's
one, two, third printing.
Third printing, yes. Luckily, the topic is still very much in the news, as we know. So
luckily or unluckily, you haven't wiped out surveillance and spying
right,
yet, Heidi.
Not yet.
But your book is going a long way to making an impact.
Oh, thanks, Michael.
So thank you so much for writing it and being around the country speaking. And where's your next one so we can tell our listeners?
I'm going to the San Antonio Book Fair in early April.
Heidi, in person, you've heard her wonderful voice, but then you'll see her wonderful person. Heidi, tell us the next one after that, and we'll keep it posted.
Okay, thanks. Michael, in a welcome addition to the corporate-sponsored media world that we live in, there's a new media venture, and I understand they've just issued a report.
Yes, actually, they're starting, I guess you'd call it an online magazine. It's part of a broader media effort called firstlook.org, and you can go to firstlook.org to get what they're doing. But the first part of it's a magazine or an online magazine called The Intercept, and the three editors of The Intercept are Glenn Greenwald, who I'm sure all our listeners know, Jeremy Scahill, I'm sure all our listeners know, and Laura Poitras, likewise, a filmmaker who's now living in Berlin and completing a film, I think, on the surveillance state.
And Laura was instrumental in bringing forth Edward Snowden's revelations.
Right. In fact, Laura was, I think, the person who first was involved in the contacts, et cetera, with Edward Snowden. Those three people have come together to do this new online magazine or newsletter, what you call it, The Intercept. They have others with them as well. And their first story was an important one. The first story, written by Scahill and Greenwald, and their first story is called The NSA's Secret Role in the U.S. Assassination Program. The key to that story has to do with killing by drones. And you can go to The Intercept and read the story. But the important part of the story is that oftentimes, if not almost all the time, but certainly oftentimes, people are droned to death based solely on electronic surveillance without any human intelligence. And what they do is they monitor people's cell phones and SIM cards, find their locations, and then based on that, drone them to death with that kind of intelligence.
Michael, and, can I just say that is one of the most astonishing things I'd heard. We know electronic surveillance is so imperfect, contains so many errors, and that, you know, recent reports have found really hasn't stopped any credible threat. So you're saying that it's not even checked by human beings or investigated after the electronic surveillance?
According to this story, they base it primarily on monitoring the handsets and the SIM cards of people. And as the article points out, as Greenwald's and Scales article points out, it's ridiculous because people hand off their SIM cards and phones all the time. And actually, some people, it says in the article, have as many as 16 different SIM cards. And sometimes they put all the SIM cards into a big pile and just take some. So we're killing people without any knowledge, really, of who we're killing. And they have some amazing expressions that Greenwald and Scahill bring out in the article. The NSA reported in one of the documents or something that they saw, the motto that caught on was called, quote, "We track them," the NSA, "we track them, you whack them."
Oh, my God.
So they're furnishing their information to the CIA. Another interesting thing that came out in the article is the NSA also equips drones and other aircraft, I'm getting this from the article, with devices known as, quote, "virtual base tower transceivers." Now, I'm familiar with that from another story, which I'll tell you. A virtual base tower transceiver is a fake cell phone tower. So they fly it up in a drone. It's a fake cell phone tower. Every cell phone goes into that cell phone tower first before it goes out to...
Isn't that called a Stingray? Well, either EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, or the Electronic Privacy Information Center has done work to expose that.
The NSA is running the cell phone system, getting every single call into its own tower. And the reason I'm slightly familiar with it is we believe there was one of those placed right outside of Julian Assange's home in the Ecuador embassy in London that was picking up every single bit of cell traffic, not just Julian's, but mine and everybody else and the ambassadors that are in there. Another expression that comes out in the article, in addition to track them and whack them, is called F3, find, NSA find, fix, which is get their location, and then finish them. Find, fix, and finish. And they have names for these programs that Jeremy and Glenn bring out in the article. They have names, and I won't go through them all, but things like a word like Gilgamesh, which, of course, is what the old Iraqi or Persian name for their foundation story. Another name, Irish names, which they use often, shenanigans. Mm-hmm. Another name for is victory dance. So that's the first article that came out.
On firstlook.org.
On firstlook.org, that's right. Correct. And the magazine, which you can follow on Twitter as well, online magazine, is called The Intercept. So follow it. It's an important new series of revelations.
And can we link to it on lawanddisorder.org?
Yes, we can. We can link to The Intercept on lawanddisorder.org. Now, speaking of drones, which have been killing people, there's been a lot of debate again about whether they're going to kill an American in Pakistan, who they claim might be al-Qaeda. There's apparently a division within the whatever our government about whether he is al-Qaeda or not, and they're claiming that they may want to drone him to death. And that's come out publicly. We don't know his name. We do know he's in Pakistan. And they claim that they can't go in and actually arrest him or get him in another way. They have to drone him. But just remember this. They went in and they killed bin Laden in Pakistan. So why can't they go in and arrest this man in Pakistan? And we at the center, of course, represented al-Awlaki and his son who were killed by drones. Again, al-Awlaki being an American. And our position has been really twofold broadly. One is that you can't be droning anyone outside a war zone. That's not acceptable. This isn't an international war. It's not a terror. It's not. There's no big war on terrorism, and that shouldn't be allowed. And secondly, particularly an American, but I actually think everybody has a right to due process before they're droned to death.
Of course,
you have to go to a court and say this person fits a criteria that we actually can't get them, which seems that they can get them with going into a country, but they also have to have proof that what the person's going to do is imminent. is concrete and specific. In other words, they're about to push a button to launch a missile on the United States. Short of that, and short of a war, you can't do this. So again, we're seeing drones in the news. All of Obama's assurances that after the May 2013 speech that he was going to draw the line more narrowly about who to drone to death are just BS, especially when you read this new story in The Intercept about using essentially electronic surveillance to kill people.
The drone goes over, finds the person, and then sends a missile.
Right. And then missiles come off the drone and kill the person.
But can't there also be collateral damage in terms of people around that person?
It seems almost always. Yeah. Many civilians are killed in these. The numbers that we get vary a lot, from in the hundreds to, you know, maybe 1,000 or more.
And we may not know the real
truth.
There's
no real way to know. But certainly a lot of civilians are killed because they're tracking a cell phone. The person is sitting with his family or other people. They're killing him. And there's recently, I think, one where they attacked a wedding party and a number of people were killed at the wedding party. I think that was in Yemen. So it's going on. I think we'll look back on this, I hope, someday. Mm. You know, is one of the worst human rights violations of this period.
Barbaric.
Yeah, really barbaric is the right word, Heidi.
Michael, wasn't there a recent ruling related to Guantanamo?
Yes, there was, and I always like to remind our listeners, it's been over 5 years now. Obama promised to close it within 1 year. It's still open. Since the May speech in 2013, when he said we would definitely get this closed, only 11 people have been released, so it's gone from 166 to 155. Over half of those have been cleared for release. I just want to keep reminding people that people have been there now for 12 years that are completely innocent, and they are not released yet, and they can be. But the recent ruling was in a way interesting and in a way terrible. It was lauded by a lot of our lawyers who work on Guantanamo because it's the first time that a court of appeals has said, we won't just consider whether the person is being held with enough evidence or not enough evidence, which has always been a standard they haven't been willing to look at very fairly, but now we're willing as a court to oversee the conditions at the prison as parts of those suits. So if a person's being abused, we'll look at that. Up until now, they haven't been willing to look at it. 12 years later, they've only been willing to look at, is this person, quote, an enemy combatant, or is it part of, you know, associated forces of Al-Qaeda, all of which have gone really nowhere, almost nowhere in the courts. So now in this lawsuit in the D.C. Circuit, they've said we're going to look at the conditions that people are being held on. So that's positive that after 12 years that they're finally looking at conditions.
And which court are we talking about?
The D.C. Circuit.
Oh, got it.
So they're going to look at that. But at the same time they said they're going to look at it, what did they do? They started to look at it. I'm reading from a Times article. They rejected a request by three detainees on a hunger strike for an injunction barring the government from force-feeding them. So they raised in this same case, we're being force-fed illegally, we're being force-fed in a manner that constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, if not torture. We're strapped into restraint chairs, tubes are inserted through their noses into a gastric tube, and liquid is poured into their stomachs through the tube. If you've ever seen pictures of it, incredibly brutal, incredibly brutal. And of course, the court refused to actually say that that was illegal or enjoin it, even though, as I would say, two things about it. The medical literature and actually what many countries follow, including Israel, interestingly enough, is they don't force feed their prisoners on a hunger strike. They let them die if they go that far, or in Israel's case, they oftentimes release them. In Ireland, as people may recall or may remember, 30 years ago almost, I think Bobby Sands and others died at hunger strikes rather than be force-fed. Mm. That is the rule, and it makes sense. It's like you being in a hospital. You have a right to refuse treatment. You have a right, as whether it's a prisoner or in a hospital, to refuse treatment. But so here's what the judge wrote, who wrote the opinion saying, yeah, we can hear challenges to conditions, but here's what the judge said about it. Absent exceptional circumstances, prison officials may force-feed starving inmates actually facing the risk of death. Petitioners point to nothing, petitioners, the people being force-fed, point to nothing specific to their situation that would give us a basis for concluding that the government's legitimate penological interests cannot justify the force feeding of hunger-striking detainees at Guantanamo.
The penological interests in a country where we're mass incarcerating hundreds of thousands of individuals, stripping their rights to education, rehabilitation. And the other thing is it'll draw attention to it. I fear that the public doesn't hear about Guantanamo that much anymore.
I think that's completely right, Heidi. They only heard about it after the hunger strikes, when 100 and some people were on hunger strike. Then Obama gave that speech in May 2013, said he was going to change it. And then, like all Obama speeches, you know, what does he do? He does very little.
Michael, there's a lot happening in recent weeks related to the boycott, divest, and sanction movement.
You know, it's taking off in a way that I don't think even activists had the expectations for. I mean, there was a big Dutch bank in Europe that pulled all, a Dutch pension fund that pulled all its money out of five big banks in Israel. And in Europe, it's really catching on. And even Kerry warned Israel they were facing isolation as a way of trying to force them into some kind of, quote, settlement or framework with the Palestinians. So there's a big push going on.
And why do you think this was sparked?
You know, I think it's just people are sick and tired of it. Right. There's been two intifadas. BDS is a nonviolent way of making the point. People understand that what's happened here is the oppression of the Palestinians, both within Israel. And if people want to know about that, they should listen to our interview last week with Max Blumenthal about his new book, Goliath. Incredible interview, incredible book. So people are becoming aware of what's happening in Israel, and particularly, of course, in the occupied territories, where people are under a system that I just read a long piece that could be argued as akin to slavery. Mm. Certainly apartheid, and has attributes of an enslaved people. So I think people are sick and tired of it. Europeans are tired of it. The Palestinians are obviously very tired of it. Now, here in the United States, of course, it's taken off as well. The American Studies Association, and we've talked about this, had language in their latest resolution saying that Israeli academic institutions ought to be boycotted. In other words, we shouldn't send professors to those universities. We shouldn't deal with those universities. They're part of the oppressive state of Israel right now. And they passed a resolution about that. There was a very swift reaction in this country against it. I don't know how many hundreds, scores of college presidents opposed it. But then it went into state legislatures. It went into the New York State Legislature with a bill sponsored by Sheldon Silver and others saying that any university that paid for its professors to go to conferences in which the American Studies Association was participating or essentially sponsoring would be cut off of any state funding. So let me see if I can explain that. I'm a member of the ASA. I'm a university professor. My college often pays for me to go to the conference of the ASA. If they do that, this New York State bill would have completely cut off all state funding to that college. Now, interestingly, there was a lot of opposition to it, including by a lot of people who don't like BDS. So, for example, Lee Bollinger, the head of Columbia, president of Columbia, put in a letter saying, this is against free speech. It's against the First Amendment. It's against the free speech of the ASA. And then there was a massive, massive campaign. And actually, the bill was removed, was taken off the fast track in the New York State Assembly and tabled for a while. But of course, these people never want to let it die. And Sheldon Silver has put in a revised bill that's more limited in terms of the penalties to the university, which it just takes away the money that they pay that goes to the ASA. But nonetheless, it cuts dead against free speech. And that bill has to be opposed in the New York State Legislature. Other legislatures around the country are doing similar bills. And there is now one that's been introduced to the House Education Committee in the U.S. Congress. And the CCR, along with
the National Lawyers Guild,
and importantly, CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, have asked the House Education Bill to oppose the anti-boycott bill. Advocates assert the bill violates the First Amendment. So there's a big pushback, but there's a big fight back as well.
Now, I just want to mention for some of our affiliates across the country, some of the other states where similar bills have been introduced. Maryland is one. Florida, Pennsylvania, Illinois all have some versions of bills or resolutions. But the worst one, Michael, is the one that's been introduced into the U.S. Congress, although doesn't seem to have that much support.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully.
So we're at an amazing moment, a remarkable moment in terms of the Palestine Solidarity Movement right now. And I urge you, there'll be links on our site. I urge you to listen to Max Blumenthal's interview and go to the CCR and NLG and CARE websites to get active on this campaign to oppose this legislation that violates the First Amendment.
Michael, I have to ask, do you think we are getting an accurate picture of what's going on in the Ukraine right now?
You know, I've always been skeptical because what happens in this country, the narrative is it's all the protesters, it's all because they don't want to sign an agreement with the West on trade, and there's lots of support in the newspapers for the protesters, very little about what are a fascist element within those protesters going back to the Nazis, and very little about what's really going on in the Ukraine and other countries that border between Europe and Russia. And my broader view, without really that much knowledge, has always been that there's a fight going on with Europe trying to keep pushing Russia back and take what were the old Russian Confederate states and put them into the NATO sphere. And I knew about the agreement that Ukraine refused to sign, that had a provision in there, not just on trade, but also one that basically would militarize the Ukraine with European and perhaps NATO troops as well. And recently, finally, there's been some people writing and talking about it who know something. And the article I would recommend is by Stephen F. Cohn, who just came out with an incredible piece in The Nation called Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresent Putin, Sochi, and Ukraine. And you can go and read that article yourselves. He was also on Democracy Now! I just want Heidi to read the paragraph that I think that is important on it that he says.
But the most crucial media omission is Moscow's reasonable conviction that the struggle for Ukraine is yet another chapter in the West's ongoing U.S.-led march toward post-Soviet Russia, which began in the 1990s with NATO's eastward expansion and continued with U.S.-funded NGO political activities inside Russia, a U.S.-NATO military outpost in Georgia, and missile defense installations near Russia. Whether this long-standing Washington-Brussels policy is wise or reckless, it, not Putin's December financial offer to save Ukraine's collapsing economy, is deceitful. The European Union's, quote, civilizational proposal, for example, includes, quote, security policy provisions, almost never reported, that would apparently subordinate Ukraine to NATO. Any doubts about the Obama administration's real intentions in Ukraine should have been dispelled by the recently revealed taped conversation between a top State Department official, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. ambassador in Kiev. The media predictably focused on the source of the, quote, leak, and on Nuland's verbal gaffe. But the essential revelation was that high-level U.S. officials were plotting to, quote, midwife a new anti-Russian Ukrainian government by ousting or neutralizing its democratically elected president. That is, a coup.
So again, you know, we're getting fed such terrible stuff by our media on Russia, Sochi, and the Ukraine that I strongly recommend go to The Nation, go to the website, read Steve Cohn's article, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresent Putin, Sochi, and Ukraine. Thank you. the repression of those involved across the country in Occupy Wall Street continues even years later in perhaps what is the last of the cases repressing activists. A woman named Cecily McMillan is facing 7 years in prison after being beaten by the New York police, a beating that left her unconscious at an event marking the six-month anniversary of the occupation in Zuccotti Park. The Occupy Wall Street activist is charged with felony assault on a police officer, which is a Class D felony in New York. In the course of being arrested, McMillan sustained bruised ribs, had a seizure, and had numerous cuts across her body. McMillan is a political organizer, and activists speculate that's why the prosecutor is seeking the full penalty. Cecily's attorney, Marty Stoller, joins us today to give us some background on the case.
Marty Stoller, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you, Heidi.
It seems we're looking at the last of the Occupy Wall Street trials in New York City, and once again, you're in the thick of things. Tell us briefly about Cecily McMillan's case. Why is she facing 7 years in prison?
Cecily is indicted, which is somewhat unusual in the Occupy Wall Street cases. There are only two serious felonies that actually made it through the indictment process. Cecily's is one of them. She's indicted in a one-count indictment accusing her of assault in the second degree, a Class D felony under the New York penal law. And she is accused of assaulting the police officer with the intent to disrupt his ability to perform his official duties, whatever they were. She whacked him in the face with her elbow and left a good-sized mouse under his left eye, causing him some substantial pain and also to miss some work. The circumstances, however, under which she delivered the blow with her elbow to his cheekbone are really what the trial is about. Cecily is not the kind of a person who would be assaulting a police officer just for the hell of it. Essentially, what we're going to prove at the trial is that Cecily was in Zuccotti Park on the night of the six-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street's setting up the encampment in Zuccotti Park. The police, at some point about midnight, decided to clear the park of all the people who were there to celebrate the anniversary. Cecily was there not necessarily to celebrate the anniversary, but to meet somebody to continue her pub crawling on St. Patrick's Day, being a McMillan. When Cecily is grabbed on her from behind on her right breast and sort of jerked upwards, and she reacts. Her arms go up in the air and her elbow goes up, and that's when her elbow makes contact with the police officer's cheekbone. Sort of a reaction and a startled reaction to being grabbed in an inappropriate place. At that point, Cecily is pushed down on the ground, hits her head on the sidewalk, and really has no memory of what occurred until she wakes up somewhat later in a hospital. She was definitely unconscious, and there is video that shows that she had what was apparently a seizure. She was handcuffed after the video that shows that she was somewhat brutally attacked by some police officers. She was then handcuffed and put on a bus where she suffered a seizure, at least one seizure, or what appears to be a seizure, and then transported to, after a long time, EMS took her to a hospital where she was treated, and all of a sudden she realizes that she's got bruises all over her body. She's got a bruised rib. She's got cuts all over her back. She's got bumps on her head, and she really has no idea how that occurred. She's then taken to a precinct and then back to another hospital, and finally, about 40 hours after she's arrested, she appears before a judge and is released on the felony charges of assaulting the police officer. It has taken us 2 years now to come to the point where we're ready to go to trial with the case, and we are prepared to prove that even though her elbow made contact with the police officer, it is the equivalent of an accident rather than some kind of criminal act.
Now, Marty, to me this seems like a no-brainer. If an individual wanted to assault a police officer, I would think it would be hard to get that elbow sort of you know, up in the air into a face, if you weren't being either tackled or, you know, roughhoused in some way.
It strikes me as extraordinarily unusual for somebody who was dressed up in bright green for St. Patrick's Day and who has a history of putting forward resolutions at General Assembly and working group meetings with Occupy Wall Street that push the notion of nonviolent political action, to say that this person somehow had it in her mind that she was going to intentionally engage in an assault on a police officer on this particular night, really is a stretch of the truth. And it calls for great imagination, which is not supported by any evidence in the case.
Marty, you know, I'm interested in why they're pursuing this with such vehemence. I mean, I just can't get over it. And then how do you look at it in the context of all the other Occupy Wall Street cases that you've handled and that others have handled?
Well, why they're pursuing it with such vehemence, I cannot tell you. You'd have to ask Cyrus Vance, the district attorney of New York County, that question. It is a felony. A police officer was assaulted. And even though there were some other assaults alleged during the OWS arrests, they all were dropped to misdemeanors or less. Cecily, for whatever reason, was singled out as somebody to be prosecuted for a felony, and they didn't even offer her a decent plea in the case. The plea that was offered to her was plead guilty to what you're charged with, that is, put a felony on your record, and we'll promise to give you probation. It would be difficult for Cecily to plead guilty to a crime that she did not commit. So the plea bargain, to the extent that you can call it a bargain, has been rejected. But in the context of all the OWS cases that I was the attorney for, this is really one of the more harsh prosecutions. I just don't understand why they are pushing it forward in such a fashion where the officer maybe lost a couple of days of work, but was back on the job and doing his work. His vision was not impaired. His eye was not affected. And he had a bruise. He had a mouse. He had a black eye. So off we go.
Marty, did you say this was on videotape, or did people take any photos when it was happening?
There is one particular piece of videotape that both the prosecution and the defense in this case are going to rely on, taken by someone from a slight distance away, that shows pretty much what we say happened. The DA has a different version of it. The DA says, well, it obviously shows an intentional assault. We say it shows an elbow hitting the guy's cheekbone that was a reaction to her being grabbed on the right breast.
Is Cecily pressing her own charges against the NYPD for the abuse she suffered?
Not yet.
Okay.
Cecily has brought no kind of a case. She's brought no complaints. She's been sitting quietly waiting anxiously for a trial that will vindicate her. Then, if there are potential remedies available, she will avail herself of them.
Marty, are you going to put in evidence about what happened to her? I mean, how did she get all those bruises?
Well, I'm not sure that I am going to be allowed to put that into evidence, nor do I think it is necessary to put it into evidence. The question at the criminal trial is not who assaulted Cecily, but the question at the trial is whether Cecily assaulted the police officer. And that is really what the focus is of that. The bruises that she had on her body that she woke up with will be the subject of testimony. But the only bruise that is going to make a difference, and we have photographs of it, are the bruises on her right breast, where there is what appears to be a handprint.
No.
And this is a pretty good, solid photograph that was taken by the doctor that she consulted very shortly after she was released from jail. The doctor herself took this picture, made it part of the medical records, and there it is. So we will have Cecily's right breast bruised in front of the jury to let them decide whether or not that supports her testimony, that that's what caused her reaction that resulted in the elbow in the cop's face.
To leave a mark to leave a bruise, that must have been an incredibly aggressive grabbing.
That's what it appears to be on the video, and certainly that's what Cecily recalls took place. Obviously, we have not had an opportunity to question the police officer involved. I suspect somehow that he's going to deny that that took place, but I don't know what he's going to say under oath yet.
Remarkable, Marty. I'm amazed they're going forward with this kind of case. Well, Marty, good luck, and give Cecily our support.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
Thanks, Marty. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Here on Law and Disorder, we've covered the issue of children sentenced to prison for life without parole for offenses committed during adolescence. In the last few years, the U.S. Supreme Court has accepted the argument that children, even those convicted of homicide, are different than adults and deserve a chance at redemption. But many state courts are not following the spirit of the Supreme Court's decisions. In Florida, the number one state that puts children in prison for life without possibility of parole, several lawsuits have been brought accusing the state of handing out massive sentences in non-homicide cases that basically amount to life without parole. We're joined today by Jody Kent-Levy, the director of the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, the organization calling on states to reconsider mandatory terms. Jody, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It might astonish our listeners to know that approximately 2,500 individuals in this country have been sentenced to life without parole for crimes committed as children. Before we talk about policy and reform, at what age is a person considered a child?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in recent cases in Roper v. Simmons, Graham v. Florida, and Miller v. Alabama that they define children as anybody under the age of 18.
What are some of the crimes these individuals have committed?
Well, the majority of people who have been sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for crimes committed as youth were involved in homicide cases. Human Rights Watch estimates that 25% of those individuals were convicted of felony murder, meaning they either weren't the primary perpetrator or they weren't, you know, there at the time that the crime was committed, but weren't, you know, the triggermen. In addition, I think it's important to note that Human Rights Watch has estimated that the majority of these individuals, 60%, had no prior records, which means that this most extreme sentence has been imposed on people that we could not define as our most serious offenders.
Many people who may have experience with working with children's groups or have read up about this know that children's minds don't really form until they're in their 20s, I think. And the Supreme Court has acknowledged that, saying that, in effect, children are different. Recently, we had a Supreme Court decision that upheld that. And what has the impact of that decision been on courts? Didn't they urge courts to depart from these strict sentences?
That's right. The three cases I mentioned, Roper, Graham, and Miller, have all come down in the last decade, and as recently as June of 2012, when the Miller v. Alabama decision was issued, which struck down mandatory life without parole sentences for children. each of these cases, the court has relied on growing bodies of research that really articulate the fundamental differences between children and adults. As any parent knows, young people, as teens, are not the same individuals. Their characters are not fully grown, and there are a number of fundamental differences that we see between children and adults in terms of their ability to assess risks, their ability to assess the consequences of their actions, as well as their ability to deal with peer pressure. We know they're more susceptible to peer pressure as teens, and significantly, they have a unique capacity to change and grow out of. We know studies have shown that they tend to, the vast majority of them, grow out of any criminal behavior. So given that, the court has said that we cannot impose these most extreme sentences on our children. The court has said that children are constitutionally different when it comes to sentencing. So in Miller, with the court striking down mandatory life without parole sentences for children, they have now required that at sentencing, certain factors about children that are unique to children must be considered before a judge can impose these extreme sentences. And they also said that these sentences must be uncommon, given the unique factors about children.
Meaning that it shouldn't be the norm.
And I just will add that we are the only country in the world known to impose these sentences on our children, and that they are concentrated, two-thirds of the people serving the sentence are concentrated in just 5 states, which I think, you know, really raises concerns for people who, you know, may argue that this is a public safety issue. You know, in New York, there's nobody serving this sentence, and in Pennsylvania, you know, the state that leads the nation in this practice, there are 500. So are we to believe that children are much more incorrigible in Pennsylvania than they are in New York? I think that's certainly not the case. You know, when you look at the rest of the world, we are certainly out of step with the international community on this issue, and the court, I think, has really articulated that there's a need to scale back these extreme sentences and look, in many cases, for the first time at how we hold young people accountable for serious crimes.
In the states where these sentences are concentrated, what is the justification?
Mm-hmm. If you look back at how these policies came to be, you know, during the 1990s, there was this theory known as the super predator theory, that there was going to be a juvenile crime wave, and that there were these individuals, these children, who were called juvenile super predators, who were considered to be incorrigible, and people who would be out in your neighborhood committing heinous acts. And the only way to deal with them was to impose harsh sentences on them. And as a result of that theory and sort of truth in sentencing, which was at its peak in the 90s, it became easier to try children in the adult criminal justice system where these sentences are available, and the sentences became longer in the adult system. So the confluence of these laws made it easier to try young people as adults and give them these life without parole sentences. So it's not like Pennsylvanians ever rose up and said, we want to sentence our children to die in prison. Rather, this came as a consequence of tough-on-crime policies that came about during the 90s, which now we know we're very much rooted in this theory that has been disproven. The super predator theory has since been disproven by the criminologists who were even the authors who've come back and said, you know, we were wrong about this juvenile crime wave. It never came to fruition. And in fact, we believe rehabilitation is the most appropriate way to handle these cases with regards to children. And so we've learned a lot in the last several decades. And now, you know, with the court saying that the states need to look at their sentencing policies as they relate to children, we now have an opportunity to be really mindful and careful about how we implement policies at the state level that hold young people accountable for serious crimes, but do it in an age-appropriate way with a focus on rehabilitation and reintegration into society.
Now, what's been the response since the Miller case, for example, by some of these states? Have they given discretion back to the judge? Has there been a decrease in these sentences?
Yeah, I mean, it's been very mixed. You know, certainly at this point, for any child who's facing a life without parole sentence, there is now a required discretion. Some legislatures have, you know, abolished life without parole altogether, Wyoming and Texas and Delaware among them. And some states, frankly, have reacted by imposing the next harshest available sentence, which would be a discretionary life without parole sentence, and other extreme alternatives, 50, 40 years. And as a result, that's obviously sort of not taking into account the guidance from the court in Miller and is likely to lead to future litigation in those states. Frankly, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to ensure that states really are careful in how they approach this, you know, this responsibility they have to create meaningful alternatives to these extreme sentences. You know, we can look to the international community for models. We can also look to, you know, some of the programs we have here in the United States, very small, probably underfunded programs like the Mendota Treatment Center in Wisconsin, which holds young people who have been convicted of homicide and gives uses a treatment model and gives them mental health services and has among the lowest recidivism rates of any program out there of its kind, certainly much lower than locking these kids up for decades and decades and then either letting them die in prison or releasing them to the streets.
I actually used to work for an Alternatives to Incarceration program for youth, and in addition to really the cost that such punitive measures bring to families and communities, it's also financially costly to lock someone up for life. What about the issue of retroactivity? Is it being applied retroactively in states that are moving forward with reforms?
Yep. So that's also been very mixed across the country. Some state Supreme Courts have issued rulings saying that Miller should be retroactive, and others have said that it should not be. I mean, one of the, you know, sort of at the thrust of this issue is, as I said earlier, we've learned a lot in the last several decades about adolescent development, about criminology and how to handle young people when they come in conflict with the law. And I think given that, the Supreme Court ruled the way it did in Roper Graham and Miller and said that, you know, children are different. We need to take into account these fundamental differences when we hold them accountable. And so to say that a young person faced with life without parole, a life without parole sentence after June 25th, 2012, should, you know, have the opportunity to have these factors considered, their unique characteristics as children considered before, you know, receiving an extreme sentence like this. But somebody, you know, sentenced in May of 2012 before Miller was issued should not have access to what we learned and to the ways that we have, that the court has really required us to improve our justice system is frankly just unfair. And so, you know, we expect that this is something that will ultimately go back up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We know that partners in Pennsylvania and Louisiana in particular are filing cert petitions to bring this up to the U.S. Supreme Court because those states have ruled that Miller is not retroactive. So ultimately, this will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
What kind of grassroots response are families becoming advocates in this issue? Are there places that people who want to get involved can check out on the website, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, we at the campaign work with a whole array of different stakeholders, including families of people serving the sentence, formerly incarcerated individuals who were in the system as youth, convicted of serious crimes and are out now and doing incredibly well. And also, we work with families of victims. We feel that it's incredibly important to amplify the voices of these individuals who are directly impacted by these policies. We work closely with them in the states where we're doing work and at the national level. We also have a United States map on our website where anybody who is interested in getting involved can sign their name up to demonstrate that they support age-appropriate alternatives to these extreme sentences for children, can find out what's going on in their states, and by signing up, will get contacted by us at the campaign when there are opportunities to weigh in at the local and national level on these issues.
Jody, tell us briefly about the campaign for the fair sentencing of youth and give us that website so we can post it on our site.
Okay, it's the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth is dedicated to ending the practice of sentencing children to life without parole. We serve as the national hub for anybody working on this issue, pursuing reform through advocacy, litigation, public education, and organizing, and partners across the country, as I mentioned, directly impacted communities, as well as partners like people on the other side of the aisle at Right on Crime, as well as medical professionals, child welfare organizations, Boy Scouts of America, the National PTA, corrections organizations, more and more law enforcement, people who recognize that kids change and that it's inappropriate to give them these sentences that require them to die in prison. And our website is www.fairsentencingofyouth.org.
Jody, are these young individuals housed in the same facilities as, say, adults, or are they in special correctional institutions?
That's a very good question. It really varies across the country. In some states, young people are housed in adult jails and prisons. And in some states, they wait until they turn 18 and then transfer them into the adult system. But one of the major issues is that because these young people are serving life sentences, oftentimes they are not given access to rehabilitative programs, which we know young people are uniquely susceptible to, right? The juvenile justice system was founded upon this notion that young kids can change. And if we give them rehabilitative programs, they will age out of criminal behavior and they will improve themselves. They will learn from their mistakes and age out of this behavior. And unfortunately, when young kids are transferred into the adult system and given these extreme sentences, they're warehoused for decades without access to this kind of rehabilitative programs that we know work particularly well for young people.
On a final note, can you tell us how you personally got involved in this field?
Absolutely. I actually started this work as a volunteer out in Los Angeles County. I was serving in the Jesuit Volunteer Corps out there and had the opportunity to visit with young people incarcerated in LA County, all of whom were being tried as adults. I got to know these young kids and realized very quickly that had I been in their shoes, faced with the challenges that they had growing up, I'd be in the very same place. I reflect very often on that experience, and one kid in particular who I think about a lot is a 15-year-old kid who I worked with weekly and who, you know, at the young age of 15 looked me in the eyes and told me he had no hope for his life. And I knew then and there we had failed our children significantly, that we, you know, locked these kids up and our society had discarded these kids, decided that it was appropriate to give up on some of them. And my perspective is that we can't give up on any of them, and that many of these kids were out here, you know, we say we're fighting for a second chance, and many of them never received a first chance. And so it's our responsibility as a society to make sure that every child has the opportunity to fulfill their potential as human beings, and every child has an opportunity to improve their lives. So, you know, that's why I do this work, and frankly, I think it's an important responsibility we all share.
It is indeed a humbling experience to meet young people behind bars and a sorry indictment of this society. Jody Kent Levy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.